The compliant applies biblical principles to his friendship. See Matthew 18. He confronts his friend on her control and intimidation. He tells her that the next time she tries to control him, he will leave. He does not attempt to control her. Confrontation isn't an ultimatum meant to rob her of her choices. He sets limits to let her know that her control hurts him and wounds their friendship. Such limits protect the compliant from further hurt. The aggressive controller can become as angry or intimidating as she wants, but the compliant won't be around to get hurt. He will be out of the room, the house, or the friendship until it's safe to come back. The aggressive controller experiences the consequences of her actions. Not having her friend around may force her to miss the attachment, and she can begin to take responsibility for the control that ran her friend off. 8. Now what? At this point, if both friends are open, the two can renegotiate the relationship. They can set new ground rules such as, "I'll stop nagging if you'll stop being critical," and can build a new friendship. Conflict number 3. Compliant, manipulative controller. "Kathy, I'm in a real jam, and you're the only one I can depend on to help me out. I can't get a babysitter for the kids, and I have this church meeting." Kathy listened to the plight of her friend Sharon. It was the usual story. Sharon neglected to plan for events, to call ahead for sitters. She often called Kathy to help out in these self-induced emergencies. Kathy hated being stuck in this position. Sharon didn't do it on purpose, and she needed her for a good cause, but Kathy still felt used and exploited. What was she to do? Many friendships get stuck in this interaction between compliance and manipulative controllers. Why do we call Sharon controlling? She's not consciously trying to manipulate her friend. However, no matter what her good intentions are, when she's in a jam, Sharon uses her friends. She takes them for granted, thinking that they shouldn't mind doing a friend a favor. Her friends go along, saying, "Well, that's just Sharon." They stifle their resentment. Let's run this conflict through our boundary checklist. 1. What are the symptoms? The compliant, Kathy, feels resentment at the manipulative controller's, Sharon's, last-minute requests. Kathy feels as though her friendship is being taken for granted. She begins to avoid her friend. 2. What are the roots? Sharon's parents rescued her from every jam, from finishing term papers at 3 a.m. to lending her money when she was well into her 30s. She lived in a very forgiving universe, where nice people would always help her out. She never had to face her own irresponsibility and lack of discipline and planning. As a child, Kathy didn't like her mother's hurt look when she said no. She grew up afraid of hurting others by setting boundaries. Kathy would do anything to avoid conflict with friends, especially with Sharon. 3. What is the boundary conflict? Sharon doesn't plan ahead and take responsibility for her schedule. When responsibilities get away from her, she calls out to the nearest compliant for help, and Kathy comes running. 4. Who needs to take ownership? Kathy, the motivated party in this conflict, sees how her never-ending yes contributes to Sharon's illusion that she doesn't ever have to plan ahead. Kathy needs to stop feeling like a victim and take responsibility for saying no. 5. What does she need? Kathy needs to connect with others who will support her as she looks at the boundary issues between her and her friend. 6. How does she begin? Kathy practices saying no with supportive friends. In a supportive atmosphere, she learns to disagree, to state her opinion, and to confront. They all pray for strength and guidance in this relationship. 7. How does she set boundaries? At their next lunch, Kathy tells Sharon about her feelings of being used and taken advantage of. She explains how she'd like a more mutual relationship. Then she lets her friend know that she won't be taking any more emergency babysitting jobs. Sharon, unaware of how she was hurting her friend, is genuinely sorry about the problem. She begins to take more responsibility for her schedule. After a few futile attempts to get Kathy to babysit at the last minute, and having to miss a few important meetings, she starts planning for events a week or two ahead of time. 8. What happens next? The friendship grows and deepens. Over time, Kathy and Sharon laugh over the conflict that actually brought them closer. Conflict number 4. Compliant, non-responsive. Remember the Marcia-Tammy friendship at the beginning of this chapter? One friend doing all the work and the other coasting illustrates the compliant, non-responsive conflict. One party feels frustrated and resentful, the other wonders what the problem is. Marcia sensed that the friendship wasn't as important to Tammy as it was to her. Let's analyze the situation. 1. What are the symptoms? Marcia feels depressed, resentful, and unimportant. Tammy, however, may feel guilty or overwhelmed by her friend's needs and demands. 2. What are the roots? Marcia always feared that if she didn't control her important attachments by doing all the work, she'd be abandoned. So she became a Martha to everyone else's Mary, a worker instead of a lover. Luke 10:38-42. Tammy has never had to work hard for friendships. Always popular and in demand, she's passively taken from important friendships. She's never lost anyone by not being responsive. In fact, they work harder to keep her around. 3. What is the boundary conflict? There could be two boundary conflicts here. First, Marcia takes on too much responsibility for the friendship. She's not letting her friend bear her own load. Galatians 6:5. Second, Tammy doesn't take enough responsibility for the friendship. She knows that Marcia will come up with activities from which she can pick and choose. Why work when someone else will? 4. Who needs to take ownership? Marcia needs to take responsibility for making it too easy for Tammy to do nothing. She sees that her attempts to plan, call, and do all the work are disguised attempts to control love. 5. What do they need? Both women need support from other friends. They can't look objectively at this problem without a relationship or two of unconditional love around them. 6. How do they begin? Marcia practices setting limits with supportive friends. She realizes that she will still have friendships in which each friend carries her own weight if she and Tammy break off their friendship. 7. How do they set boundaries? Marcia tells Tammy about her feelings and informs her that she will need to take equal responsibility for their friendship in the future. In other words, after Marcia calls, she won't call again unless Tammy does. Marcia hopes that Tammy will miss her and begin calling. If worst comes to worst, and the friendship atrophies due to Tammy's unresponsiveness, Marcia has gained something. She's learned it wasn't a mutual connection in the first place. Now she can grieve, get over it, and move on to find real friends. 8. What happens next? The mini-crisis changes the character of the friendship permanently. It either exposes it for a non-relationship, or it provides soil for the rebuilding of a better one. Questions about friendship boundary conflicts. Boundary conflicts in friendships are difficult to deal with because the only cord tying the relationship together is the attachment itself. There's no wedding ring, there's no job connection, there's just the friendship. And it often seems all too fragile and in danger of being severed. People who are in the above conflicts often raise the following questions when they consider setting boundaries on their friendships. Question number 1. Aren't friendships easily broken? Most friendships have no external commitment, such as marriage, work, or church, to keep the friends together. The phone could just stop ringing, and the relationship die with no real ripples in the lives of the participants. So aren't friendships at greater risk of breaking up when boundary conflicts arise? This type of thinking has two problems. First, it assumes that external institutions such as marriage, work, and church are the glue that holds relationships together. It assumes that our commitments are what hold us together, not our attachments. Biblically and practically, nothing could be further from the truth. We hear this thinking in many Christian circles. If you don't like someone, act like you do, or make yourself love them, or commit to loving someone, or choose to love someone and the feelings will come. Choice and commitment are elements of a good friendship. We do need more than fair-weather friends. However, Scripture teaches us that we can't depend on commitment or sheer willpower, for they will always let us down. Paul cried out that he did what he didn't want to do, and he didn't do what he wanted to do, Romans 7:19. He was stuck. We all experience the same conflict. Even when we commit to a loving friendship, bad things happen. We let them down. Feelings go sour. Simply white-knuckling it won't re-establish the relationship. We can solve our dilemma the same way Paul solved his. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Romans 8:1. The answer is being in Christ Jesus. In other words, in relationship with Christ, both vertically and horizontally. As we stay connected to God, to our friends, and to our support groups, we are filled up with the grace to hang in there and fight out the boundary conflicts that arise. Without this external source of connection, we're doomed to an empty willpower that ultimately fails or makes us think we're omnipotent. Again, the Bible teaches that all commitment is based on a loving relationship. Being loved leads to commitment and willful decision-making, not the reverse. How does this apply to friendships? Look at it this way. How would you feel if your best buddy approached you and said, "I just wanted to tell you that the only reason we're friends is because I'm committed to our friendship. There's nothing that draws me to you. I don't particularly enjoy your company, but I will keep choosing to be your friend." You probably wouldn't feel very safe or cherished in this relationship. You'd suspect you are being befriended out of obligation, not out of love. Don't let anyone fool you. All friendships need to be based on attachment, or they have a shaky foundation. The second problem with thinking that friendships are weaker than institutionalized relationships, such as marriage, church, and work, is in assuming that those three aren't attachment-based. It simply isn't true. If it were, wedding vows would ensure a 0% divorce rate. Professions of faith would ensure faithful church attendance. A hiring would ensure 100% attendance at work. These three important institutions, so crucial to our lives, are, to a large degree, attachment-based. It's scary to realize that the only thing holding our friends to us isn't our performance, or our lovability, or their guilt, or their obligation. The only thing that will keep them calling, spending time with us, and putting up with us is love. And that's the one thing we can't control. At any moment, any person can walk away from a friendship. However, as we enter more and more into an attachment-based life, we learn to trust love. We learn that the bonds of a true friendship are not easily broken, and we learn that in a good relationship, we can set limits that will strengthen, not injure, the connection. Question number 2. How can I set boundaries in romantic friendships? Single Christians have tremendous struggles with learning to be truth-tellers and limit-setters in romantic dating friendships. Most of the conflicts revolve around the fear of losing the relationship. A client may say, "There's someone in my life whom I like a lot, but I'm afraid if I say no to him, I'll never see him again. A couple of unique principles operate in the romantic sphere. One, romantic relationships are, by nature, risky. Many singles who have not developed good attachments with other people and who have not had their boundaries respected try to learn the rules of biblical friendships by dating. They hope that the safety of these relationships will help them learn to love, be loved, and set limits. Quite often, these individuals come out of a few months of dating more injured than when they went in. They may feel let down, put down, or used. This is not a dating problem. It's a problem in understanding the purpose of dating. The purpose of dating is to practice and experiment. The end goal of dating is generally to decide, sooner or later, whether or not to marry. Dating is a means to find out what kind of person we complement and with whom we are spiritually and emotionally compatible. It's a training ground for marriage. This fact causes a built-in conflict. When we date, we have the freedom to say, at any time, this isn't working out, and to end the relationship. The other person has the same freedom. What does this mean for the person whose boundaries have been injured? Often, she brings immature, undeveloped aspects of her character to an adult romantic situation. In an arena of low commitment and high risk, she seeks the safety, bonding, and consistency that her wounds need. She entrusts herself too quickly to someone whom she is dating because her needs are so intense, and she will be devastated when things don't work out. This is a little like sending a 3-year-old to the front lines of battle. Dating is a way for adults to find out about each other's suitability for marriage. It's not a place for young, injured souls to find healing. This healing can best be found in non-romantic arenas, such as support groups, church groups, therapy, and same-sex friendships. We need to keep separate the purposes of romantic and non-romantic friendships. It's best to learn the skill of setting boundaries in these non-romantic arenas, where the attachments and commitments are greater. Once we've learned to recognize, set, and keep our biblical boundaries, we can use them on the adult playground called dating. 2. Setting limits in romance is necessary. Individuals with mature boundaries sometimes suspend them in the initial stages of a dating relationship in order to please the other person. However, truth-telling in romance helps define the relationship. It helps each person to know where he starts and the other person stops. Ignorance of one another's boundaries is one of the most blatant red flags of the poor health of a dating relationship. We'll ask a couple in premarital counseling, "Where do you disagree? Where do you lock horns?" When the answer is, "It's just amazing. We're so compatible. We have very few differences." We'll give the couple homework. Find out what you've been lying about to each other. If the relationship has any hope, that assignment will generally help. Question number 3. What if my closest friends are my family? Boundary-developing individuals sometimes say, "But my mother, or father, or sister, or brother, is my best friend." They often feel fortunate that, in these times of family stress, their best friends are the family in which they were raised. They don't think they need an intimate circle of friends besides their own parents and siblings. They misunderstand the biblical function of the family. God intended the family to be an incubator in which we grow the maturity, tools, and abilities we need. Once the incubator has done its job, then, it's supposed to encourage the young adult to leave the nest and connect to the outside world. Genesis 2:24. To establish a spiritual and emotional family system on one's own, the adult is free to do whatever God has designed for him or her. Over time, we are to accomplish God's purpose of spreading his love to the world, to make disciples of all the nations. Matthew 28:19-20. Staying emotionally locked into the family of origin frustrates this purpose. It's hard to see how we'll change the world when we have to live on the same street. No one can become a truly biblical adult without setting some limits, leaving home, and cleaving somewhere else. Otherwise, we never know if we have forged our own values, beliefs, and convictions, our very identity, or if we are mimicking the ideas of our family. Can family be friends? Absolutely. But if you have never questioned, set boundaries, or experienced conflict with your family members, you may not have an adult-to-adult connection with your family. If you have no other best friends than your family, you need to take a close look at those relationships. You may be afraid of separating and individuating, of becoming an autonomous adult. Question number 4. How can I set limits with needy friends? I was talking to a woman one day in session who felt extremely isolated and out of control. Setting limits with her friends seemed impossible for her. They were in perpetual crisis. I asked her to describe the quality of her relationships.
"Oh, I've got lots of friends. I volunteer at the church 2 nights a week. I teach a Bible study 1 a week. I'm on a couple of church committees, and I sing in the choir."
"I'm getting exhausted just listening to you describe your week," I said. "But what about the quality of these relationships?"
"They're great. People are being helped, they're growing in their faith, and troubled marriages are getting healed."
"You know," I said, "I'm asking you about friendships, and you're answering about ministries. They're not the same thing."
She had never considered the difference. Her concept of friendship was to find people with needs and throw herself into a relationship with them. She didn't know how to ask for things for herself,
and that was the source of her boundary conflicts. Without these ministry relationships, this woman would have had nothing, so she couldn't say no. Saying no would have plummeted her into isolation, which would have been intolerable. But it had happened anyway. She had come for help because of burnout. When the Bible tells us to comfort with the comfort with which we are comforted, 2 Corinthians 1:4, it's telling us something. We need to be comforted before we can comfort. That may mean setting boundaries on our ministry so that we can be nurtured by our friends. We must distinguish between the two. A prayerful look at your friendships will determine whether you need to begin building boundaries with some of your friends. By setting boundaries, you may save some important ones from declining. And when romantic dating relationships lead to marriage, you will still need to remember how to build and maintain boundaries even in this most intimate of human relationships. Chapter 9. Boundaries and Your Spouse. If there were ever a relationship where boundaries could get confused, it is marriage, where by design husband and wife become one flesh. Ephesians 5:31. Boundaries foster separateness. Marriage has as one of its goals the giving up of separateness and becoming, instead of two, one. What a potential state of confusion, especially for someone who does not have clear boundaries to begin with. More marriages fail because of poor boundaries than for any other reason. This chapter will apply the laws of boundaries, as well as its myths, to the marital relationship. Is this yours, mine, or ours? A marriage mirrors the relationship that Christ has with his bride, the church. Christ has some things that only he can do. The church has some things that only it can do, and they have some things they do together. Only Christ could die. Only the church can represent him on earth in his absence and obey his commands. And together, they work on many things, such as saving the lost. Similarly, in marriage, some duties one spouse does, some the other does, and some they do together. When the two become one on their wedding day, spouses do not lose their individual identities. Each participates in the relationship, and each has his or her own life. No one would have a problem deciding who wears the dress and who wears the tie. It's a little trickier to decide who balances the checkbook and who mows the lawn. But these duties can be worked out according to the spouse's individual abilities and interests. Where boundaries can get confusing is in the elements of personhood, the elements of the soul that each person possesses and can choose to share with someone else. The problem arises when one trespasses on the other's personhood, when one crosses a line and tries to control the feelings, attitudes, behaviors, choices, and values of the other. These things only each individual can control. To try to control these things is to violate someone's boundaries, and ultimately it will fail. Our relationship with Christ, and any other successful relationship, is based on freedom. Let's look at some common examples. Feelings. One of the most important elements that promotes intimacy between two people is the ability of each to take responsibility for his or her own feelings. I was counseling a couple who were having marital problems because of the husband's drinking. I asked the wife to tell her husband how she felt when he drank.
"I feel like he doesn't think about what he's doing. I feel like he..."
"No. You are evaluating his drinking. How do you feel about it?"
"I feel like he doesn't care."
"No," I said. "That is what you think about him. How do you feel when he drinks?" She started to cry.
"I feel very alone and afraid."
She had finally said what she felt. At that point, her husband reached out and put his hand on her arm. "I never knew you were afraid," he said. I would never want to make you afraid." This conversation was a real turning point in their relationship. For years, the wife had been nagging her husband about the way he was and about the way he should be. He responded by blaming her and justifying his actions. In spite of hours and hours of talking, they had continued to talk past each other. Neither was taking responsibility for his or her own feelings and communicating them. We do not communicate our feelings by saying, "I feel that you..." We communicate our feelings by saying, "I feel sad," or "hurt," or "lonely," or "scared," or... Such vulnerability is the beginning of intimacy and caring. Feelings are also a warning signal telling us that we need to do something. For example, if you are angry at someone for something she did, it is your responsibility to go to her and tell her you are angry, and why. If you think that your anger is her problem and that she needs to fix it, you may wait years, and your anger may turn to bitterness. If you are angry, even if someone else has sinned against you, it is your responsibility to do something about it. This was a lesson Susan needed to learn. When her husband, Jim, did not come home from work early enough for them to have time together, Susan became angry. Instead of confronting her husband, she would become very quiet for the rest of the evening. Jim became annoyed with having to pull out of her what was wrong. Eventually, hating her pouting, he left her alone. Not dealing with hurt or anger can kill a relationship. Susan needed to talk with Jim about how she was feeling instead of waiting for him to draw her out. Even though she felt he had been the one who had hurt her, she needed to take responsibility for her own hurt and anger. Jim and Susan did not solve their problem by her simply expressing her anger to him. She needed to go one more step. She needed to clarify her desires in the conflict. Desires. Desires are another element of personhood that each spouse needs to take responsibility for. Susan was angry because she wanted Jim to be home. She blamed him for being late. When they came in for counseling, our conversation went like this. "Susan, tell me why you get angry at Jim," I said.
"Because he's late," she replied.
"Well, that can't be the reason," I said. "People don't make other people angry. Your anger has to come from something inside of you."
"What do you mean? He's the one who comes home late."
"Well, what if you had plans to go out with your friends that night? Would you still be angry at him for being late?"
"Well, no. That's different."
"What's different?" "You said you were angry because he was late.
and he would still be late, yet you wouldn't be angry.
Well, in that situation, he wouldn't be doing anything to hurt me.
Not exactly, I pointed out. The difference is that you wouldn't be wanting something that he didn't want to give. Your disappointed desire is what hurts you, not his being late. The problem lies in who is responsible for the want. It is your want, not his. You are responsible for getting it fulfilled. That is a rule of life. We do not get everything we want, and we all must grieve over our disappointments instead of punish others for them.
What about common respect? Staying at the office is selfish, she said.
Well, he wants to work some nights, and you want him home. Both of you want something for yourselves. We could say that you are as selfish as he is. The truth is that neither one of you is selfish. You just have conflicting wants. This is what marriage is about, getting conflicting wants worked out. There was no bad guy in this situation. Both Jim and Susan had needs. Jim needed to work late, and Susan needed him home. Problems arise when we make someone else responsible for our needs and wants, and when we blame them for our disappointments. Limits on what I can give. We are finite creatures and must give as we decide in our heart to give. 2 Corinthians 9:7. Being aware of when we are giving past the love point to the resentment point. Problems arise when we blame someone else for our own lack of limits. Often, spouses will do more than they really want to, and then resent the other for not stopping them from overgiving. Bob had this problem. His wife Nancy wanted the perfect home, including handmade patios, landscaping, and remodeling. She was always coming up with something for him to do around the house. He was beginning to resent her projects. When he came to see me, I asked him why he was angry.
Well, because she wants so much. I can't find any time for myself, he said.
What do you mean, can't? Don't you mean won't?
No, I can't. She'd be angry if I didn't do the work.
Well, that's her problem. It's her anger.
Yes, but I have to listen to it.
No, you don't, I said. You are choosing to do all of these things for her, and you are choosing to take the tongue lashings that happen if you don't. Any time you spend doing things for her is a gift from you. If you do not want to give it, you don't have to. Stop blaming her for all of this. Bob didn't like that. He wanted her to stop wanting instead of his learning to say no. How much time do you want to give her each week for home improvement? I asked. He thought for a minute.
About 4 hours? I could work on things for her and still have a little time left for a hobby.
Then tell her that you have been thinking about your time, and that with all the other things you are doing for the family, you would like to give her 4 hours a week to work around the house. She's free to use that time any way she chooses.
But what if she says that 4 hours is not enough?
Explain to her that you understand that this may not be enough time to complete all the jobs she wants done, but those are her wants, not yours. Therefore, she is responsible for her own wants, and she is free to be creative in how she gets them done. She could earn some extra money and hire someone. She could learn to do them herself. She could ask a friend to help. Or she could cut down on her wants. It's important that she learns that you are not going to take responsibility for her wants. You're going to give as you choose, and she is responsible for the rest. Bob saw the logic in my suggestion and decided to talk with Nancy. It was not pretty at first. No one had ever said no to Nancy before, and she did not take well to it. But over time, Bob took responsibility for his limits instead of wishing that Nancy would not want so much, and his limits took effect. She learned something that she had never learned before. The world does not exist for her. Other people are not extensions of her wants and desires. Other people have wants and needs of their own, and we must negotiate a fair and loving relationship and respect each other's limits. The key here is that the other person is not responsible for our limits. We are. Only we know what we can and want to give, and only we can be responsible for drawing that line. If we do not draw it, we can quickly become resentful. Applying the Laws of Boundaries to Marriage. In Chapter 5, we talked about the 10 Laws of Boundaries. Let's apply a few of those laws to troubled marital situations. The Law of Sowing and Reaping. Many times, one spouse may be out of control and may not suffer the consequences of this behavior. The husband yells at his wife, and she tries to be more loving. In effect, the evil, yelling, produces good things, more loving for him. Or a wife overspends, and her husband pays the consequences. He gets a second job to cover the mound of bills. Natural consequences are needed to resolve these problems. A wife needs to tell her overly critical husband that if he continues to berate her, she will go into another room until he can discuss the problem rationally. Or she could say something like, "I will not talk about this issue with you any more alone. I will only talk in the presence of a counselor." Or, "If you start yelling at me again, I will go to Jane's house to spend the night." The husband with the spendthrift wife needs to cancel the credit cards or tell her she needs to get a second job to pay the bills. These spouses all need to let the out-of-control spouses suffer the consequences of their actions. A friend of mine decided to let his wife suffer the consequences of her chronic lateness. He had nagged and nagged his wife about her tardiness to no avail. Finally, he realized he could not change her. He could only change his response to her. Tired of suffering the consequences of her behavior, he decided to give them back to her. One night, they had plans to go to a banquet, and he did not want to be late. In advance, he told her that he wanted to be on time and that if she were not ready by 6 p.m., he would leave without her. She was late, and he left. When he came home that night, she screamed, "How could you leave without me?" He let her know that her lateness was what caused her to miss the banquet, and that he was sad to have to go alone, but he did not want to miss the dinner. After a few more incidents like this, she knew that her lateness would affect her and not him, and she changed. These moves are not manipulative, as the other spouse will accuse. They are examples of someone limiting how they will allow themselves to be treated and exhibiting self-control. The natural consequences are falling on the shoulders of the responsible party. The Law of Responsibility. We talked earlier about taking responsibility for ourselves and having responsibility to others. The above examples show that. People who set limits exhibit self-control and show responsibility for themselves. They act responsible to their partner by confronting him or her. Setting limits is an act of love in the marriage. By binding and limiting the evil, they protect the good. Taking responsibility for someone's anger, pouting, and disappointments by giving in to that person's demands or controlling behavior destroys love in a marriage. Instead of taking responsibility for people we love, or rescuing them, we need to show responsibility to them by confronting evil when we see it. This is truly loving our partner and the marriage. The most responsible behavior possible is usually the most difficult. The Law of Power. We have looked at our basic inability to change another person. A nagging spouse, in effect, keeps the problem going. Accepting someone as she is, respecting her choice to be that way, and then giving her appropriate consequences is the better path. When we do this, we execute the power we do have, and we stop trying to wield the power no one has. Contrast these ways of reacting. Before boundaries. "Stop yelling at me. You must be nicer." After. "You can continue to yell if you choose to, but I will choose not to be in your presence when you act that way." Before boundaries. "You've just got to stop drinking. It's ruining our family. Please, listen, you're wrecking our lives." After. You may choose to not deal with your drinking if you want, but I will not continue to expose myself and the children to this chaos. The next time you are drunk, we'll go to the Wilsons for the night, and we'll tell them why we are there. Your drinking is your choice. What I will put up with is mine.
Before boundaries.
You are a pervert to look at pornography. That's so degrading. What kind of a sick person are you, anyway?
After? I will not choose to share you sexually with naked women in magazines. It's up to you. I will only sleep with someone who is interested in me. Make up your mind and choose.
These are all examples of taking power over what you do have power over, yourself, and giving up trying to control and have power over someone else. The Law of Evaluation. When you confront your husband or wife and begin to set boundaries, your partner may be hurt. In evaluating the pain that your boundary setting causes your spouse, remember that love and limits go together. When you set boundaries, be lovingly responsible to the person in pain. Spouses who are wise and loving will accept boundaries and act responsibly toward them. Spouses who are controlling and self-centered will react angrily. Remember that a boundary always deals with yourself, not the other person. You are not demanding that your spouse do something, even respect your boundaries. You are setting boundaries to say what you will do or will not do. Only these kinds of boundaries are enforceable, for you do have control over yourself. Do not confuse boundaries with a new way to control a spouse. It is the opposite. It is giving up control and beginning to love. You are giving up trying to control your spouse and allowing him to take responsibility for his own behavior. The Law of Exposure. In a marriage, as in no other relationship, the need for revealing your boundaries is important. Passive boundaries, such as withdrawal, triangulation, pouting, affairs, and passive-aggressive behavior, are extremely destructive to a relationship. Passive ways of showing people that they do not have control over you never lead to intimacy. They never educate the other on who you really are. They only estrange. Boundaries need to be communicated first verbally and then with actions. They need to be clear and unapologetic. Remember the types of boundaries we listed earlier? Skin, words, truth, physical space, time, emotional distance, other people, consequences. All of these boundaries need to be respected and revealed at different times in marriage. Skin. Each spouse needs to respect the other's physical body boundaries. Physical boundary violations can range from hurtful displays of affection to physical abuse. The Bible says that the husband and wife have authority over each other's body. 1 Corinthians 7, 4-6. This is mutual authority given freely. One should always remember Jesus' principle. Treat others as you would want to be treated. Words. Your words need to be clear and spoken in love. Confront your spouse directly. Say no. Don't use passive resistance. Don't pout or withdraw. Say things like, "I do not feel comfortable with that. I do not want to. I won't." Truth. Paul says that each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully. Ephesians 4:25. Honest communication is always best. This includes telling the other person when he is not aware that he is violating one of God's standards. You also need to own the truth about your feelings and hurts, and communicate those feelings directly to your spouse with love. Physical space. When you need time away, tell your spouse. Sometimes you need space for nourishment. Other times, you need space for limit setting. In either instance, your spouse should not have to guess why you do not want him around for a while. Communicate clearly so your spouse does not feel as though he is being punished, but knows he is experiencing the consequences of his out-of-control behavior. Matthew 18:17, 1 Corinthians 5:9-13. emotional distance. If you are in a troubled marriage, where your partner has had an affair, for example, you may need emotional space. Waiting to trust again is wise. You need to see if your spouse is truly repentant, and your spouse needs to see that her behavior has a cost. Your spouse may interpret this as punishment, but the Bible teaches that we are to judge a person by her actions, not by her words. James 2:14-26. In addition, a hurt heart takes time to heal. You cannot rush back into a position of trust with too much unresolved hurt. That hurt needs to be exposed and communicated. If you are hurting, you need to own that hurt. Time. Each spouse needs time apart from the relationship, not just for limit setting, as we pointed out above, but for self-nourishment. The Proverbs 31 wife has a life of her own. She is out doing many things. The same is true of her husband. They have their own time for doing what they like and for seeing their own friends. Many couples have trouble with this aspect of marriage. They feel abandoned when their spouse wants time apart. In reality, spouses need time apart, which makes them realize the need to be back together. Spouses in healthy relationships cherish each other's space and are champions of each other's causes. Other people. Some spouses need the support of others to set boundaries. If they haven't ever stood up for themselves, they need help from friends and the church in learning how. If you are too weak to set and enforce boundaries, get help from supporters outside your marriage. Do not, however, seek support from someone of the opposite sex that could lead to an affair. Get help from other people within relationships that have built-in boundaries, such as counselors or support groups. Consequences. Communicate consequences clearly and enforce them firmly as you have said you would. Spelling out consequences in advance and enforcing them gives your spouse a choice about whether or not he or she wants the consequences to happen. Because people have control over their own behavior, they have control over the consequences of that behavior.
But that doesn't sound submissive.
Whenever we talk about a wife setting boundaries, someone asks about the biblical idea of submission. What follows is not a full treatise on submission, but some general issues you should keep in mind. First, both husbands and wives are supposed to practice submission, not just wives. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, Ephesians 5:21. Submission is always the free choice of one party to another. Wives choose to submit to their husbands, and husbands choose to submit to their wives. Christ's relationship with the church is a picture of how a husband and wife should relate. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Ephesians 5:24-27. Whenever submission issues are raised, the first question that needs to be asked is, what is the nature of the marital relationship? Is the husband's relationship with his wife similar to Christ's relationship with the church? Does she have free choice, or is she a slave under the law? Many marital problems arise when a husband tries to keep his wife under the law, and she feels all the emotions the Bible promises the law will bring: wrath, guilt, insecurity, and alienation. Romans 4:15, James 2:10, Galatians 5:4. Freedom is one issue that needs to be examined. Grace is another. Is the husband's relationship with his wife full of grace and unconditional love? Is she in a position of no condemnation, as the church is, Romans 8:1? Or does her husband fail to wash her of all guilt? Usually, husbands who quote Ephesians 5 turn their wives into slaves and condemn them for not submitting. If she incurs wrath or condemnation for not submitting, she and her husband do not have a grace-filled Christian marriage. They have a marriage
under the law. Often, in these situations, the husband is trying to get his wife to do something that either is hurtful or takes away her will. Both of these actions are sins against himself. Husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. Ephesians 5:28-29. Given this, the idea of slave-like submission is impossible to hold. Christ never takes away our will or asks us to do something hurtful. He never pushes us past our limits. He never uses us as objects. Christ gave himself up for us. He takes care of us as he would his own body. We have never seen a submission problem that did not have a controlling husband at its root. When the wife begins to set clear boundaries, the lack of Christ-likeness in a controlling husband becomes evident, because the wife is no longer enabling his immature behavior. She is confronting the truth and setting biblical limits on hurtful behavior. Often, when the wife sets boundaries, the husband begins to grow up. A question of balance.
I can't get him to spend any time with me. All he wants to do is go with his friends to sporting events. He never wants to see me,
Meredith complained. What do you say to that? I asked her husband.
That's not true at all, Paul replied. It feels like all we have is togetherness. She calls me at work 2 or 3 times a day. She's waiting at the door when I get home and wants to talk. She has our evenings and weekends all planned out. It drives me crazy. So I try to get away and go to a game or to play golf. I feel smothered.
How often do you try to get out?
Any time I can. Probably about 2 nights a week and 1 afternoon on the weekend.
What do you do at those times? I asked Meredith.
Well, I wait for him to come home. I miss him very much.
Don't you have something you want to do for yourself?
No. My family is my life. I live for them. I hate it when they're gone and we can't have time together.
Well, it's not like you never have time together, I said. But it is true that you don't have all the time together. And when that happens, Paul seems to be relieved and you are distressed. Can you explain that imbalance?
What do you mean, imbalance? She asked.
Every marriage is made up of 2 ingredients, togetherness and separateness. In good marriages, the partners carry equal loads of both of those. Let's say there are 100 points of togetherness and 100 points of separateness. In a good relationship, one partner expresses 50 points of togetherness and 50 points of separateness, and the other does the same. They both do things on their own, and that creates some mutual longing for the other, and the togetherness creates some need for separateness. But in your relationship, you have divided the 200 points differently. You are expressing all of the 100 together points, and he is expressing the 100 points of separateness. If you want him to move toward you, I continued, you need to move away from him and create some space for longing. I don't think Paul ever gets a chance to miss you. You're always pursuing him, and he is turning away to create space. If you would create some space, he would have some space to long for you in, and then he would pursue you.
That's exactly right, Paul broke in. Honey, it's like when you were getting your graduate degree and were gone so much. Remember? I used to long to see you. I don't get a chance to miss you now. You're always around.
Meredith was reluctant to concede my point, but eager to explore with Paul ways to bring balance to their marital relationship. Balance. It's something that God has wired into every system. Every system tries to find balance in any way it can, and many dimensions need to be balanced in a marriage. Power, strength, togetherness, sex, and so on. Problems come when, instead of trading places in these areas, one spouse is always powerful and the other powerless. One spouse is always strong and the other weak. One spouse always wants togetherness and the other wants separateness.
One spouse always wants sex and the other doesn't. In each case, the couple has struck a balance, but it is not a mutual balance. Boundaries help create mutual balance instead of split balance. They help couples keep each other accountable. If someone does not have boundaries and begins to do another's work for him, such as creating all the togetherness in the relationship, that person is on the road to codependency, or worse. The other partner will live out the opposite end of the split. Boundaries keep partners accountable through consequences and force the balance to become mutual. The preacher in Ecclesiastes says, "There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven." 3:1. There are balanced polarities in life and relationship. When you find yourself in an unequal relationship, you may lack boundaries. Setting boundaries may correct the imbalance. For example, when Paul sets boundaries on Meredith's demands, he forces her to become more independent. Resolution. It is often easy to see problems, but difficult to make the hard choices and risks that result in change. Let's look at the steps toward personal change in a marital relationship. 1. Inventory the symptom. First, you need to recognize the problem and agree to take action to solve it. You will not resolve the problem by wishing. You need to own the problem, whether it be sex, discipline of the children, lack of togetherness, or unfair spending of money. 2. Identify the specific boundary problem. One step beyond identifying the symptom is putting your finger on the specific boundary issue. For instance, the symptom may be that one person does not want sex. The boundary problem may be that this person does not say no often enough in other areas of the relationship, so that this is the one place that she has some power. Or she may feel as if she does not have enough control in the sexual arena. She may feel powerless. She may feel that her choices are not honored. 3. Find the origins of the conflict. This is probably not the first relationship in which this boundary issue has arisen. You probably learned to relate this way in a significant relationship in the family in which you grew up. Certain fears that were developed in that relationship are still operative. You need to name these original issues. You may need to stop confusing your parent with your spouse. No other relationship repeats parental conflicts more often than the marriage relationship. 4. Take in the good. This step involves establishing a support system. Remember, boundaries are not built in a vacuum. We need bonding and support before we build boundaries. The fear of abandonment keeps many people from setting boundaries in the first place. For this reason, establish a support system that will encourage boundary setting in your marriage. This may be a codependency group, Al-Anon, a therapist, a marriage counselor, or a pastor. Do not set boundaries alone. You have not set boundaries because you are afraid. The only way out is through support. And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart, Ecclesiastes 4:12. Boundaries are like muscles. They need to be built up in a safe support system and allowed to grow. If you try to shoulder too much weight too quickly, your muscles may tear or be pulled. Get help. 5. Practice. Practice new boundaries in safe relationships. Relationships in which people love you unconditionally. Tell a good friend no when you can't do lunch, or let her know when your opinion differs from hers, or give something to her without expecting anything in return. As you practice setting limits with safe people, you will begin to grow in your ability to set limits in your marriage. 6. Say no to the bad. Put limits on the bad in your marriage. Stand up to abuse. Say no to unreasonable demands. Remember the parable of the talents. There was no growth without risk and a facing up to fear. Being successful is not as important as stepping out and trying. 7. Forgive. To not forgive is to lack boundaries. Unforgiving people allow other people to control them. Setting people who have hurt you free from an old debt is to stop wanting something from them. It sets you free as well. Forgiving